guardian.co.uk.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for February the 18th. Coming up on this special edition of the show, we're in Boston for the AAAS Science Conference. We'll be hearing from the world's leading scientists about the future of food technology. Are you ready to start eating GM cornflakes or cloned meat? Also in the podcast, how close are we to discovering life on Mars? Stephen Squires from NASA's Mars rover missions explains the next stages of exploring the red planet. Plus,
when I came to MIT 40 years ago, there was one computer shared by thousands of students. It cost $11 million. The computer on your cell phone today is a million times cheaper, a million times smaller, and 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase.
Inventor and futurist Raymond Kurzweil tells us why technology is going to save the world. All this and bad news for sharks, the science of ice cream, and why chickens are better rock fans than us mere humans. You want fries with that, hun? This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. We're here and sort of live-ish in Boston, just around the corner from Harvard and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, or MIT. More specifically, we're in Toscanini's Ice Cream and Coffee House, an establishment which, in this part of the world at least, is almost as famous as those two universities. For the past 30 years, Gus Rancatoria and family have been serving up the city's best ice cream to some of the leading scientific minds on the planet. We're going to hear from Gus later in the show, and all being well, we're going to try some of his ice cream too. First, though, let me introduce you to your panel for this week. James Randerson is the Guardian science correspondent and a man so consumed by rage that he shaved off his beard. James, I bet you're pleased that you shaved off the beard just for the coming to Boston for the winter.
I've got a very cold chin.
Also here with insight and analysis is Olive Heffernan from Nature magazine. Hello, Olive.
Hello, Alec.
And that is real accent, isn't it? You're not just one of those people pretending to come to America to reconnect with their Irish ancestry, are you?
Well, funny you should mention that. I get mistaken for an American at least once a week.
That's really good. Well, we need some American accents on this show, I think. Well, very good. So, why have The Guardian flown me, James, and our producer, Ben, who is actually genuinely here, out to Boston for the past week? Well, it's a good question. And despite what some of our employers might be thinking, the answer ain't just to eat fried shit with cheese and drink apple teenies. No, we're in town to cover the 2008 annual meeting of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. That's the AAAS to the cool kids. Let me set the scene. We've spent most of the past 7 days in the vast and mostly windowless Heinz Convention Center, surrounded by some of the least fashion-conscious people on the planet, and also by many of the world's top scientists from just about every field you can imagine. In fact, some might argue that the size of this event is evidence that when all's said and done, the geek will inherit the Earth. Now, this is my first AAAS, but someone who's a veteran of many of these affairs is Tim Radford, The Guardian's former science editor. We asked him to sum up what the conference was all about.
This is the largest single gathering of scientists from all disciplines and the public to take place in the world. It's not the oldest. The oldest is the British Association for the Advancement of Science. And this wonderful meeting, founded by people like Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell, great scientists, was a determined attempt to try and introduce rational thinking and evidence-based discussion to the life of the average citizen in a democracy. Science has become more complex, bigger, more pulsating, you might say, more more part of our lives with each year. And it's fair to say that there are now more scientists at work at the laboratory bench than have ever lived in all human history. So there's a lot to share. And what they're doing here, at some expense to themselves and to their psyches, is to try and share it with the public. So it's a good thing. However, it's a bit more than just interesting. This is an ominous meeting. This is a meeting full of omens about the future. This is the kind of forum at which things like global warming and the energy crisis and the coming water crisis are all aired at great length and in a number of very vivid ways. And an unmistakable theme of this meeting has actually been the condition of 70% of the planet. The oceans are in a mess, and there's no sign that this mess is going to right itself. We will have to do something, and even if we do something, a lot of damage has already been done and is inevitable. And it seems to me a pity that we should mess up 70% of the planet when we've never been there. It's the great unexplored place. But whatever we look at, we find things going wrong. There is change everywhere.
Tim Radford there. More from him later. Okay, well, let's get down to business. One of the most eye-catching seminars at the AAAS this year was called Dolly for Dinner, and it was all about the future of animal cloning. James, you were there. We've talked about this controversial topic several times in the pod before. What was new here?
Well, look, they brought together some people from various perspectives who were talking about what it means to be eating cloned meat and what the farmers are going to be using it for. Just a few things to throw out there. There's already something like 4,000 cloned cows in the world somewhere. They've already produced.
Where are they?
Well, mostly in America, really. They've already produced a cow that's resistant to BSE. So, you know, this is an established technology that's already out there. But there's a moratorium at the moment on these animals going into the food chain. There was a very significant decision recently from the US Department of Agriculture, who basically said cloned meat is perfectly safe because it's identical to other kinds of meat. And so they were basically giving it the green light. Now, I spoke to Patrick Cunningham, who's a professor of animal genetics at Trinity College Dublin. He's also the chief science advisor to the Irish government. He told me about the different attitudes between Americans and Europeans when it comes to cloning and GM crops.
This comes from very extensive surveys, the Eurobarometer in Europe and comparable surveys in America. And the first thing I noticed was that there's a surprising similarity of response of people to questions like, how useful do you consider, let's say, GM food, or what trust do you have in the regulatory authorities? And in most cases, in all cases where they were asked those kind of questions, the American population are more accepting of new technology, but the margin is not great. And what's also surprising, I think, is that either 50% or less than 50% in most cases really had confidence in new technology in the food industry. So despite the fact that that new technologies are coming in, there's a great deal of persuasion and interaction with the public needed if they're to accept them more readily.
Given the similarities that you remarked on there, why do you think it is that you know, there was this very contrasting reaction to GM crops?
Well, I suppose the first one is that GM crops were an American invention, so they you fly the stars and stripes over something, then it's more acceptable than if it comes in from abroad. Whereas in Europe, it's seen as an American set of technologies. And being pushed very hard by fairly powerful international corporations. And so a combination of those things, I think, the fact that it was not produced in Europe and is kind of being pushed at them by America, affects attitudes. But also the nature of the food market in Europe is different. I mean, we have different food production and consumption patterns in France and Italy and Germany and so on, of which people are proud, and they don't like the idea of being homogenized, of being sort of McDonaldized, whereas in America there really isn't that sort of sensitivity. So it goes very deep into the kind of social structures.
Given all of that, do you think it's ever likely that the European public will embrace cloned foods?
Well, I suppose if we look back at the GM story, Europe has reluctantly decided that GM crops are safe and has little by little approved GM crops both for growing and for importation as animal feed. And so it's essentially a difference in timing rather than ultimate position. I think GM crops will be quite widely grown and used in Europe some years from now, but a decade or more behind the US. And I think essentially the same sort of thing will happen with cloning. Perhaps there will be even more resistance to cloning because for the consumer, in some sense, a more challenging technology.
Professor Patrick Cunningham there. Well, we thought we'd put his theories to the test. America is, of course, the land of the hamburger. Well, actually, you don't have to look too hard to realize it's the home of the triple bacon cheeseburger too. But are these people ready to eat a cloned burger, even if it did come with extra fries? We went out and about with our microphone and roving to find out.
With human use of any animals, which we use for food, and of course many other things that we as humans use, the ethical treatment of animals is extremely important. And as long as these animals are healthy, not in pain, are treated well, the fact that they are cloned does not bother me at all.
There's nothing wrong with it. If we say stop the new technology today, then why didn't we do it in the past? If we have taken the benefits from the past, why can't we continue the benefits of the future?
If I did, I would not be concerned about safety. My reason to not eat one more has to do with the process. I'm from Vermont. I'm very pro small farms. And so I do have issues with the sort of mega agricultural complex in this country.
No, sir. I believe that, according to my understanding of the research, that it is all fine and safe. I am definitely in favor of cloning. You cannot stop research in this area. This must go on, just like in any other field, like we've had in the nuclear fusion and so on, and fission, I should say, produced the atomic bomb. The technology is useful, and this will also turn out to be useful.
I don't see any long-term studies on human health. No data yet, and so I'm reserving judgment, and no, I wouldn't eat a burger that came from cloned beef.
Interesting there that pretty much everyone said they'd have no scientific problems with cloned meat. They're concerned more by the ethical and business side of things. Olive, what do you think? Would you eat a cloned burger?
Well, I'm not a huge beef eater. In fact, I'm a pescatarian, so no, you wouldn't catch
cloned
me.
Fish, maybe.
Well, I mean, they could be actually healthier than farmed salmon. You know, That's the reality. But I would have some ethical issues with it, even if I wasn't a pescatarian.
Yeah. The thing is, I suppose, that they're not suggesting, any of these guys actually doing this, that you would eat cloned animals anyway. I mean, these things are for breeding because they're too expensive otherwise. Mm. I mean, what was it? Each cloned cow would cost something like $13,000 to rear, whereas a normal cow, $6,000. I mean, the economics just doesn't make sense to actually serve these things up on dinner plates. Is that right, James?
That is right. I think the cost difference is bigger than that even, and the sorts of things they're going to use them for are at the top end of the breeding process to try and make the best use of the traits that come along that are going to be useful for production or for animal health. And so the things that we're going to be eating, you know, there aren't going to be armies of clone cows in fields out there. We're going to be eating the progeny of clone cows, and so, well, if indeed people, you know, accept the technology.
Well, this seminar about cloned meat tied in very nicely to another talk a little later at the conference. This one was called Drugs on Our Cornflakes, and James, again, you were there. You were everywhere, weren't you?
I was, yeah. I was just roving. This one was good too. This was from the Union of Concerned Scientists, and they're very concerned about the fact.
Of course they were. Says it in their name. Were they scientists too?
Some
all
of them. Yeah. What they're concerned about is a particular branch of GM crops, if you like, the sort of next generation which will be growing pharmaceutical products and industrial products in the plants. There are certain kind of advantages to this. You know, for example, if you're making vaccines, you can make them in a form where people can just eat the plant rather than having to inject them with it, or you don't have to refrigerate the vaccine sample. So there's loads of advantages in terms of distributing vaccines in the third world and things like that. But what they're worried about is that if you get mingling between conventional varieties and these crops, then the consequences are much greater than the sort of crops that we've been thinking about so far, which are perhaps, you know, resistant to herbicides or have a pesticide gene in them. You know, what you don't want is someone to be unknowingly eating a pharmaceutical in their food. Well, I spoke to Karen Perry Stillerman. She's senior consultant for the Food and Environment Program with the UCS, and she explained why she's, well, very concerned.
Our perception is that some of them might be toxic, but all of them would certainly cause a tremendous economic upheaval. And we know that the food companies, for example, are very cautious about their brands. And so what would be the impact societally, economically, if, for example, you know, cornflakes were contaminated with some kind of drug or chemical? I think it could be a vast impact economically.
Yeah, we've heard also a lot of options for preventing that from happening. What do you think, you know, the most practical are?
Well, I think the simplest is a ban at the United States Department of Agriculture level prohibiting the use of food crops grown outdoors for this purpose. We've heard some about these alternatives using tobacco, using greenhouses, and those are good alternatives. I also know of companies that are using plant cells in stainless steel tanks in manufacturing facilities. They get some of the benefit of using plants without using whole plants grown outdoors, and so those would be good options as well.
Karen Perry-Stilleman there, a very concerned scientist. Olive, are you a fan of GM crops?
Well, personally, I have some concerns. I think in the case of these pharma crops, the concern is that the impacts could be so much greater if we have pharmaceutical ingredients that actually get transferred to non-GM crops. So I'm not a fan of that idea. And then I suppose even more concerning is the fact that Monsanto basically controls 90% of the GM crops that are out there. So we're having a Monsantoization of our agricultural industry. And I think that that's quite concerning, really, for small operators.
James, did the people in the session talk about what kinds of pharmaceuticals would go in there? I mean, you talked about it a little bit before, but take us through some of those.
It's mainly large kind of protein drugs that might be effective against cancer. I mean, this is early days in the research. There are field trials out there, but there aren't any crops being grown commercially yet. Also, vaccines are another idea. But the crux here is what do we do about it? And what they're suggesting, I mean, there are a few options, like sort of growing all the crops under glass or growing them underground, even, so that there's virtually no chance that you could get gene transfer with wild relatives or whatever.
No chance of there being sunlight down there, surely.
Well, you know, there are some people who grow cannabis in their loft without any light, and they manage to do it, so it is possible.
Enough about your life, James.
No, but I think the most sensible option is to say, look, if we're talking about pharma crops or industrial varieties, then we should be using non-food crops like tobacco. And then if there is gene transfer, it just doesn't matter because we won't be eating them.
All right, well, let's leave that there. And well done, James, for talking over the first coffee grinding of the day. Yeah, this is a live-ish radio, so you know. I don't know about you, but in spite of everything, that's made me feel rather peckish. If you have anything to say on the future of food, cloned, GM or otherwise, we want to hear from you. Post your comments on the Science blog or on our Facebook wall. I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian, live sort of from Boston. Still to come.
I like his brashness, I have to say that. I mean, it's so American. As a European, watching the way Craig Venter operates is definitely, it's a different experience.
We speak to people here at the AAAS to find out their thoughts on the ever-controversial biologist, Craig Venter. Is he good for science or just an evil genius? Plus, speaking of geniuses, we hear from a man with more than a dozen honorary doctorates, Ray Kurzweil, about why he believes technology is humanity's only hope. We're also going to let you in on a few facts about the science of ice cream making too. All of that's coming up pretty darn soon, as they like to say over here. First, though, we're going to talk about one of my favourite things in the universe. Yes, space is one of those topics we never tire of discussing here on the Science Weekly. And no, I haven't given up on being an astronaut just yet. A bit of background to get us up to speed. In 2004, NASA's two Mars rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, went to explore the planet's surface and its geology. The program so far cost more than $1 billion. That's about £20 with today's exchange rate. But against all the odds, the rovers are still sending back all sorts of data. So are we finally about to discover life on Mars? I caught up with two of the most senior members of the rover program to find out more.
I'm Andy Knoll. I'm a professor of biology at Harvard and a member of the MER science team.
I'm Steve Squires. I'm at Cornell University, and I'm the principal investigator for the MER mission.
The Mars exploration rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, have trundled across the surface of Mars for so long now, well beyond expectations. Steve, can you just take us through two or three of the highlights? And also, were you expecting them to last this long?
I was absolutely not expecting them to last this long. The longevity has surprised, I think, everyone, including those of us who built them. Some of the highlights for the rover Spirit, to me the highlight came 1,200 days into the mission when we discovered what I think is very strong evidence for a hydrothermal system on Mars in the distant past. That's the kind of environment you might find at a hot spring or a volcanic fumarole where you have hot steam and water coming out of the ground. For Opportunity, the highlight came right at the beginning. We landed, and what we saw just right off the bat was evidence for layered sedimentary rocks that spoke of water being present beneath the surface and water coming to the surface in the very distant past. And then as we've gone forward, we've learned more and more from analysis of the minerals, analysis of the chemistry, of what that environment was really like.
The exploration rovers weren't specifically meant to be looking for life. They were doing all sorts of scientific experiments. But can you tell us a bit about what the next generation of rovers will be doing when they get there? And will they specifically be looking for life signs?
Well, again, they're going to be looking for evidence of environmental history, but they will have the capability of looking more directly for life than the MER rovers did. For example, they will have certainly enhanced ability to do images both at the level of the eye and microscopically. Perhaps a bigger difference from MER is that they should be able to actually identify individual minerals, which is an important improvement. They will be able to do at least moderate quality isotopic composition for things like oxygen and sulfur, which is something that we very much would like to know about, because sulfur in particular is capable of carrying a biological signal in its isotopic composition. And they will be able to look for organic molecules, which is again of particular interest in life.
What is the smoking gun for life? What is the chemical fingerprint that you'd be looking for? As journalists, we're always asking things to be reduced to simple things. But if there's a paper that's going to be published that would get you the most excited about life, what would it be showing you?
Well, I think the major thing that one wants to look for is some pattern, either physical or chemical, that is not the expected consequence of purely physical processes. We don't know that life in some other planet in the solar system or beyond would have the same physiological attributes as terrestrial life, but physics and chemistry were probably the same on Mars as they are on Earth. So in the first instance, I would like to see evidence of strong isotopic fractionations of the type that is unusual in the absence of life, or a molecule that we know is made by life, but we have no plausible synthetic mechanism in the absence of life.
Andy Knoll there, Professor of Biology at Harvard University. More from Stephen Squires in just a second, but Olive, let me ask you something. Do you think that Mars exploration, looking for life, it's a good idea? It's a waste of money. What do you think?
I mean, the recent evidence suggests that conditions for life on Mars aren't as favourable as scientists once thought. But I think we need further exploration, and I'm optimistic that, you know, we could still find evidence of life on Mars, maybe if they probe further beneath the surface.
Fingers crossed, of course. Well, we are, of course, dealing with pretty old technology now with the Spirit and Opportunity rovers. So what improvements are in store for the successors? Here's Stephen Squires again.
The next generation rover has many technological advances over the ones that we're flying currently. Much more sophisticated set of instruments. There's been a lot of investment in instrument technology in the intervening period of time, and we're taking advantage of that. Much greater mobility capability. It can drive farther, it can drive faster. It has a nuclear power source, and so that rover will not be at the mercy of Martian dust storms that might dust up the solar arrays and make it hard to get power. So in many ways, it represents a significant advance over what has come before.
Do you have any ideas when Spirit and Opportunity will finally give up the ghost?
You know, my wife keeps asking me the same question. When is this going to end? I absolutely have no idea. They've lasted so much longer than we expected initially. We have no basis for predicting how much longer they will last. We treat each day as a gift, and we just push them as hard as we can.
Have you organized a send-off for when they do?
You know, I've tried not to think about it. It's going to be a tough day. I think it would have been a lot tougher earlier in the mission if they had died at an early age. When they do die, it will be an honorable death, and we will be proud of their accomplishments, but it'll be a sad day. I think we're going to have one heck of a party once it's all sunk in.
Let's change gear for a moment now. As we've mentioned, we're podcasting to you direct from the magnificent Toscanini's ice cream and coffee shop here in Boston. Now, factor in the wind chill, and temperatures dipped to -9 here earlier this week. But even in the middle of winter, people in Boston seem to go wild for ice cream. In fact, they consume more of it per capita than any other city in America. Gus Rancatore is the manager of this magnificent emporium, and because of the store's location just around the corner from MIT and about a mile from Harvard, he's been scooping up to many of the world's leading scientists and techies for nearly three decades. Earlier, producer Ben went behind the scenes to discover more about how he makes his ice cream.
Anthropologists or food anthropologists think that people in cold climates eat high-fat diets to stay warm, and that people in hot climates have low-fat diets that are a little bit spicier. So we're in this big college town with a lot of pretty good colleges and pretty demanding academic programs. Despite the fact that it has so many college students, it's not a hard-drinking town for the most part. And ice cream is a very gentle social premise. You can come over here, take a break from your studies, have what's called a study date, celebrate some small victory or console yourself after some small defeat, and then go back and do more work.
You've been here since the early 80s, right. And as you said, it is a big college town, and you get mostly MIT students here as opposed to the Harvard guys up the road, and that means you get a lot of scientists in here.
A lot of scientists, we get a lot of engineers. You know, over here we have two ice cream machines. These machines were built in central Massachusetts, and they're both built about around the same time. The one on the right is a gear drive machine, and the one on the left was modified by some MIT engineers so that it uses a belt drive instead of a gear drive. It's actually much more reliable and was a substantial improvement. The guys who did it were at the superconducting lab, and one became a businessman in California, and the other guy teaches at University of California, Berkeley.
Well, I'm delighted to say that Gus has joined us here now. Gus, thank you for letting us, first of all, take over your cafe. You've done some amazing things and served some amazing people, so I'm going to go for the most salacious first. Apparently, you served Nobel Prize winners ice cream made of cow dung. Can you explain that to me?
This fall, in October, over at Harvard, we were part of the Ig Nobel ceremony, which I think is going to take place in Britain sometime in mid-March. And the Ig Nobels are awards for silly achievements in science, sometimes intentional, sometimes unintentional, and the purpose is to make people laugh and also make them think. So there was a Japanese food scientist who synthesized and successfully synthesized artificial vanillin or vanillin from cow dung. It was a major achievement.
It was a major achievement. I didn't even know how to
She stands head and shoulders above all other food scientists. And this year, we actually weren't able to obtain samples of that vanillin or vanillin, but we synthesized or created a new flavor that was designed to evoke it. And then we surprised and perhaps appalled some of the Nobel Prize winners and some of the Ig Nobel Prize winners by serving them this ice cream.
Now, apparently the Dalai Lama is also eaten here. Is that true? And secondly, you didn't serve him cow dung ice cream, did you?
No, he liked chocolate ice cream. He paid for his own ice cream. There was some debate about whether he was the Dalai Lama or just a regular walking around llama. Because of things like brain and cognitive science at MIT, it's not unusual to see llamas in Cambridge. And so when he came in with a group of other religious practitioners, some of our employees were confused about who he was. Some of them might have recognized him more readily if he'd been with Richard Gere or some movie star acolyte. But somebody else told us as he was leaving that he was the Dalai Lama.
And what was he like? Was he a nice guy?
He was very quiet and had very good taste in ice cream.
You mentioned that he ate chocolate ice cream, but what are the most popular flavors that our
Chocolate's
scientist friends
the most
like?
Popular flavor. But so it might be evidence of his oneness with the zeitgeist or the spirit of the ice cream universe that he instinctively gravitated towards the most popular flavor.
That's an amazing philosophy based on ice cream, actually. Now, like we said, you're between two of the biggest and most important and lovely universities in the world, Harvard and MIT. Tell us about these students at these two places. I mean, am I right in thinking basically that science students are the best?
You're asking for a generalization, but generalizations are helpful, however many exceptions there are. And so we had a store which is temporarily closed at Harvard, and we've always been located near MIT. And I think it's more interesting to be around science and engineering students than it is to be around people who are more likely to be in the liberal arts. Harvard University has put an increasing emphasis on science education and engineering, but for the most part, Harvard students are in the traditional liberal arts. There was one friend who said that MIT students think they're smarter than you are, and they are. Harvard students think they're better than you are, and they're probably not. And he also made a comparison to Harvard students living out Brideshead Revisited fantasies that they'd gleaned from watching BBC dramas.
Is it just that Harvard students are richer than you?
Partially it's that. MIT students tend to be children of teachers and engineers, and Harvard students tend to be children of lawyers and bankers. And while there's an immense variety of student backgrounds at both schools, that's a generalization that I think is fairly accurate.
Well, I'd just like to say we love all of the Harvard and MIT students here. Can I ask you, you've hung out with a lot of these scientists for a long time. You've been to their labs. You've seen some interesting things. But have any of these scientists come up with a cure for brain freeze?
No.
So you still get brain freeze when you eat ice cream a bit too quickly?
I don't.
Do you get it?
The other night at the Ignoble events, someone was talking about the holy grail of this field and the holy grail of that field. And it would seem that in ice cream science, the holy grail, the great unsolved problem, is brain freeze.
This is it. If you've got any solutions,
probably some sort of Manhattan project will be required to solve that.
Send your ideas in. But listen, Gus, the exciting part, I've just reached the most exciting part of this this podcast, which is that you've been making a new flavor for us. Tell us a bit about this.
Actually, because we were fairly busy today, what I brought over were two other flavors rather than something brand new. But they're representative of some of the things we do.
Tell us about them.
One is hibiscus sorbet, or actually hibiscus tea sorbet.
That sounds good.
Hibiscus, I've learned from some of our customers, is the national flower of Malaysia. Uh-huh. And it's a wonderful fruity tea. And we turned that into a very nice ice cream for midwinter. We made it for a restaurant, and they served it on St. Valentine's Day last week. The other flavor I brought over is wort. And wort is an intermittent, interim stage of beer. It's before the beer is fermented, it is wort. So there's no alcohol in it, but it makes a wonderful ice cream. We get the wort from Cambridge Brewery, which is over near Kendall Square. And we turn it into ice cream, give it back to them. They give us some more, they actually give us some beer to drink. And it's sort of an economic example, as well as some intersection of beer and ice cream.
Well, you're gonna give us a bit to try. Olive, I think you should take the first pick. Which one do you fancy?
I think I'll go for the worst variety.
The wort, anything close to beer.
The wort is a terrible name.
Not to live is up it, to my possible, Irish heritage, but
it,
you know.
Is it possible to make ice cream out of anything?
It's possible to make ice cream out of almost anything. We don't make silly flavors. You know, I could take someone's tie and puree it and freeze it. But there are a lot of unusual flavors that you see in other cultures that we like to serve. So we make avocado ice cream and avocado sorbet. We make rice and rice pudding, corn ice cream. There are flavors that people like in one part of the United States but don't like very much in other parts of the United States.
I just wanted to say this, hibiscus sorbet is gorgeous.
This tastes like
it's kind of ruby colored and yeah, just lovely.
Put any food in front of James, he'll just eat it. No, we're gonna drop that there for just a second. Gus, thank you.
Don't you want to hear what the wort?
Yes,
I do.
It's a bit like burnt sugar in a really good way. It's kind of toffee, caramel.
Hang on, sounds like Guinness to me.
I need to try some of that.
Toffee and caramel.
You know, you mentioned Guinness. We make Guinness not for Irish people who are appalled by the idea, but for people from Trinidad. People from that country make Guinness pies, and they also make Guinness ice cream. And it's actually kind of nice.
Mm. The wort's really good as well. It's kind of almost butterscotchy.
It's beginning to look somewhat frog-like.
Am I?
This is
really. Ribbit.
Now, love him or loathe him, Craig Venter's never been far from the science headlines. Last month, his team created the world's first synthetic chromosome, and he's currently busy trawling the seven seas, discovering new forms of life. Oh yeah, and he took part in the race to sequence the human genome some time back. From our point of view here at The Guardian, there's no one doing more adventurous or influential research in the field of biology as Venter. Or if they are, they're certainly not publicising it as much as he is. So, at the risk of going all day-to-day, we asked, is Craig Venter good for science or bad for science?
He definitely pushes the envelope and advances the science by, you know, having commercial ventures with genome sequencing. I think people have been pushed forward to do this sort of science faster and catch up with him. Obviously, you know, his methods are different, and people might not agree that they're as high quality as they should be when we're talking about using this information for sort of more clinical things and in research. But yeah, he definitely pushes the science forward, and that's a good thing.
He does have a giant ego, but pretty much anyone that does the kind of things that he's trying to do does have a giant ego, and so I could see how he could rub people the wrong way.
I like his brashness. I have to say that. I mean, it's so American. As a European, watching the way Craig Venter operates is definitely, it's a different experience. But whether he's good or bad, I'd have to reserve judgment on that. He's certainly good fun.
I think Craig Venter is good for science because he drives an agenda and it creates a talking point and it spurs other scientists to act either with him or against him.
Every good china shop needs a good bull every once in a while, especially a good intelligent bull. You might not want to leave him untended all the time, but yeah.
Well, while we've been playing that clip, the phones have been ringing, doors have been slamming, cappuccino is being made. It's wonderful live stuff. Look, James, Olive, listen, if your mind is not too full of ice cream, tell us what you think about Craig Venter. Olive, what's your verdict of the man?
Well, I mean, I think Craig Venter he's a force of nature. He's a maverick, and I think he has to be admired for that.
He's a bit of a rock star, isn't he?
He is a bit of a rock star. And I mean, usually when you read reports of him or, you know, you see him, he's usually on his very large yacht in some remote South Pacific location, surrounded by bikini-clad ladies. And, you know, to be honest, scientists have a reputation for being geeks. So I think the fact that he's so cool, you know, has to be a good thing for science. But I think on a more serious level, you know, he has received some criticism for his scientific methods. He seems to want to go out and just collect every piece of genetic material on the planet without any specific, you know, scientific approach. And some people have criticized him for that. And I think, you know, when you think about his project for sequencing the seas, he seems to be going out and collecting every sort of DNA possible from the seas, but, you know, without really much knowledge of the organisms that live there or the ecosystems. On the other hand, you know, what he's doing has to be good for science. I think this data will be hugely valuable, and it will advance our understanding of the planet and the organisms that inhabit it.
You have to take risks, don't you? I mean, all scientists often don't know what they're going to try and discover, what they're going to find out when they start on something. And, you know, he's rich. He can kind of do what he wants. He's not beholden to anything. So, you know, why not? James, one thing I've always noticed is that you look exactly like Craig Venter when you had your beard, with your blue eyes and all that. And in fact, if anyone buys Venter's autobiography and you want to know what James looks like, that the front cover of the biography there, that's what he looks like. That's what James looks like.
Well, I look like him about 20 years. Tell us,
are you cloned from him?
What
does that mean, you think?
I'm his illegitimate child, and I will inherit all his wealth.
So does that mean when you're not working for The Guardian that you're on yachts?
Surrounded by bikini-clad women, yeah.
Well,
yeah, I love it.
Invite me. Well, listen, once again, we want to know what you guys in Podland think. I don't know, maybe we could do a poll or something, the prize for the best Venter haiku or limerick or whatever. I'm just riffing here, must be the ice cream. Listen, give us your snappy summations of Craig Venter by posting on our Facebook wall or blogs.guardian.co.uk/science. And I had to raise my voice thanks to that wonderful cleaning that's going on in the background. We're fast approaching the end of this extra special edition of Science Weekly. We've just heard about Craig Venter, who sadly wasn't in town, but one of the most illustrious faces at AAAS this year has been Raymond Kurzweil, a man who holds an extremely modest 14 honorary doctorates, and those are just the ones he's accepted. Anyways, Kurzweil's been a pioneer of things like speech recognition and all sorts of futuristic jiggery-pokery. He's also written several influential books on health, artificial intelligence, and transhumanism. He's just been on a Blue Ribbon panel to discuss how engineering and technology could address, and ultimately overcome, the environmental and energy crises, a whole host of other ills like disease, ageing, and even poverty. He told James why.
Well, certainly most of energy is not an information technology. 85% of energy comes from fossil fuels, and that's a 19th century technology. But there is this burgeoning renewable form of energy. Already we get over 1% of energy from wind and solar, but it's doubling every 2 years. Doubling every 2 years means multiplying by 1,000 in 20 years, actually well within that time. We only need 7 more doublings, which we can do in 14 years, to meet 100% of our energy needs from these renewable forms. And solar, I think, actually has the most potential because we only have to capture one part in 10,000. So it's going to grow, and it's going to ultimately push out fossil fuels. If for no other reason, it'll be much less expensive. Larry Page of Google and I, who basically drafted the energy plan, believe that the tipping point where energy from solar, The cost per watt will be less than the cost per watt from coal and oil is only 5 years away.
You mentioned that technology is going to become more and more integrated into our clothing and then into our bodies. Could you say a little bit about that?
Well, technology has been getting smaller and smaller. I mean, the computers now are in our pockets, and they're going to ultimately be woven in our clothing and in our belt buckles. We'll have devices in our eyeglasses that write images directly to our retinas, creating full immersion displays or full immersion virtual reality. These already exist. They're expensive today, but because they are information technology, they'll come down by half every year, and they'll be inexpensive within 5 years. I would say within the next decade, computers will be everywhere in the environment. In terms of going into our bodies, there are already dozens of animal experiments of nano-engineered blood cell-sized devices going inside their bloodstream and producing therapeutic effects. One scientist cured type 1 diabetes with a blood cell-sized device. Another scientist has a device that goes in the bloodstream and actually detects cancer cells and destroys them. And there's dozens of experiments like this. So that kind of nanotechnology in the bloodstream is further out. That's probably 20 years away, but that's going to happen as well because these technologies are also growing exponentially in power and shrinking exponentially in size.
Technology, kids, it's going to save us all, apparently. Olive, really, though, environmental technology, is it going to save us or is it a bit of a get out?
I think it's definitely part of the solution. I think it really has to be, but I don't think we can rely on it solely. And the reason I would say that is, I mean, if you think about the development of nanotechnology and the use of things like nanotechnology for, say, solar panels, the technology is getting there, but it's many, many years away. And in the meantime, we really need to do something much more immediate to solve the environmental crisis that we're facing. Yeah, so
basically.
I mean, if you look at the EU's targets for renewables to, you know, have 15% of energy coming from renewables by 2020, will the technology get us there in time? I think that's the crucial question. So, you know, while I agree that it's part of the solution, I don't think it's the only solution.
Well, I just don't want to assure the listeners to this podcast that everyone's flights here was offset and Ben actually swam here. You can hear our full interview with Raymond Kurzweil as this week's Science Extra. It's fascinating stuff. So if your interest has been sufficiently piqued by that snippet, head back to guardian.co.uk/science or iTunes. We heard earlier from Tim Radford, a former science editor of The Guardian and one of the wisest heads around at the AAAS this year. Yep, coffee over here, please. He's been chairing most of the press conferences, so we asked him to sum up his thoughts of the conference.
I was absolutely delighted by a wonderful discussion on fears of nanotechnology. Nanotechnology are these little monsters at the scale of a billionth of a meter that might streak through your bloodstream, or they might actually clear up your heart disease, or they might dissolve the whole planet if you listen to Prince Charles. And the research shows that the only people who are really worried about, who really see any hazard in nanotechnology, are the scientists themselves. There are perceptions of risk, but it's very difficult to see what these risks are. And of course, you can't see the nanotechnological particles because they're totally invisible. So you might say that the discussion was about nothing. In fact, a lot of science is about examining, just making sure that there are no answers, and indeed, perhaps there are no questions. And then there was another wonderful one about physics on the grand scale, which I just loved because I had on the platform scientists who had to deal, one of them had to deal with 65 countries and run a budget of at least 7 to 10 billion euros for a machine that was going to advance our knowledge of the entire universe by a factor of 100 millionth of a second. When you put it like that, you think, boy, do these guys think big.
Tim Radford again. Let's have a final word from you, James and Olive, about a couple of the other stories that have emerged. Both of you have been sort of wandering around various sessions while I've been stuck in my windowless room. Tell us your own highlights and lowlights. James, what have been some of your favourite bits?
Well, one of the kind of hottest tickets at the conference was the Obama-Clinton debate. And
they weren't there themselves, were they?
No, I know. That would have been really good. But they're actually in states that matter now because Massachusetts has already had its
There's nothing important going on this year for them, is there? They could have made it.
But they did send along their sort of representatives on Earth to talk about their science policy, and it was actually quite an interesting discussion because there was a surprising amount of detail in there, and there was quite an interesting kind of contrast in styles between the two of them. The Obama guy, Alec Ross, who's a social entrepreneur, was sort of talking about Obama's passion for science and how he was, you know, into technology even before he was running for president, and that, you know, he wants to put a hell of a lot of money into science. He's talking about doubling the research budget in the first 5 years. And Clinton, on the other hand, her representative was that was Tom Khalil, who served under Bill Clinton, and he was basically saying, look, we were really competent when we were in government last time, so let's have another go.
Yeah. Well, it makes a change from the current administration. Actually, can I criticise them here?
I think you can, no, to be honest. I mean, you know, certainly at the conference, I mean, you know, everyone hates the Bush administration with its contempt for science.
I can probably see Secret Service sort of coming around the corner right now. Olive, quickly tell us what your highlights are before I get shot.
Well, you know, I mean, I think the thing about AAAS is that you don't really get many front-page news stories from it.
Shh, don't tell anyone that.
I think it's mostly a massive celebration of science, and, you know, that's really come across this week. It's been fantastic. I suppose in terms of highlights, there's been a massive amount of research on how climate change's impact in the oceans, and some of the highlights of that have been, I think the first that springs to mind really is the fact that sharks may actually invade the Antarctic within the next 20 years, and already scientists are seeing king crab at the edges of the Antarctic waters, which really just is something that we've never observed before. The way it works on the Antarctic seabed at the moment is that there's a complete absence of like large predators such as crabs and fish. So the invertebrates and the, you know, small organisms that live on the seabed have really, you know, they're just in a safe haven, free from predators, and that's all set to change within the next 15 to 20 years if global warming continues as predicted.
And these poor animals who've been living happily with no predators around are just going to get eaten, basically.
They are. The predictions are the brittle stars are going to be hammered, but brachiopods, otherwise known as lampshells, look like they're going to fare okay. So there will be winners and losers in this game.
There were some fantastic pictures of that, actually. Actually, there was another shark story, of course, which was a bit sadder for the sharks, which is that within 50 years or so, perhaps we're going to see very few sharks around the world. The populations have plummeted all around the world because of overfishing and finning and so on. And we had the people at the World Conservation Union are going to put nine new species of shark onto the red list as endangered and threatened and so on, which is quite sad.
That was a bit of a Star Wars noise that just came out. I was wondering whether Gus serves shark fin ice cream. What do you reckon?
He doesn't serve shark fin ice cream. That'd be totally unethical. You can't do that. James, what have your sort of less interesting bits been? I was supposed to call them lowlights. What have they been?
Well, I've been... I don't want to kind of point the finger too much at any particular speakers, but, I mean... Yeah, I did go to a set of talks which had some, you know, really fascinating speakers, but it was just appallingly chaired. And, you know, the chairman introduced them not at the beginning of the session, and then the session ran on for half an hour.
Was the stuff interesting, at least, when it came out?
Some of it was interesting. Some of it was incredibly woolly. It was about, you know, the evolution of cognition. And some people were basically just saying, look, we don't know anything about this topic. We've been hammering away at it.
They convened lots of people to tell them that. That's excellent.
Yeah. I don't know. It was a weird one.
Olive, have you enjoyed every second of it, or have there been moments where you thought, God, I just wish I wasn't here?
Well, no. I mean, I think that the real low light of AAAS is the fact that you just don't get much cutting-edge research. And, I mean, some of the sessions I've been to have been quite technology-heavy. You know, the one on coal gasification, unless you were really, really in there, it was just quite detailed. There was a lot of stuff about modelling, and I suppose my interest is really in the science and where that's going. So,
do you both...
Actually, the this is supposed to be for the public and stuff. I mean, it's for journalists as well, obviously, but and yet some of the sessions are really, really detailed and really heavy, and you're like, nobody's going to understand this.
Yeah, I thought it was really, you know, what struck me was it was interesting that there were two conflicting sessions that I was interested in. One was about how to communicate climate change, and the other one was about climate change. And the one on communicating climate change was absolutely packed. And then I lift across to the other one, absolutely, you know, this room full of like 10 people in a room listening to climate scientists. And I just thought, how ironic is that? People want to, you know, hear about talking about climate change, but
It's an interesting question, this, actually. Every environment's obviously very trendy. Do you see the effects of it on conferences like this? Are there more sessions about climate change
and
all that sort of stuff?
Yeah, I mean, there's an entire stream on climate change and a separate stream on energy. And I think even if you look across the other streams, there's climate change is popping up everywhere, whether it's in the sessions on communicating science to the to the religious in America, or whether it's a session on human health and re-emerging infectious diseases. It's just like climate change is really cutting across all themes as well as having its own theme. And yeah,
they touched on it in the nuclear sessions as well, on the future of nuclear power. Mm. The background to that was, we need nuclear because it's climate.
Of course, you can hear loads of this analysis and chat on our Environment Weekly podcast, which I've just been forced to promote. Final thing from you guys, what have you learned from AAAS this week? One quick fact, both of you.
Well, I've learned that the Vatican's curator of meteorites has a bedroom above the Pope. Seriously.
You can't even check that fact. You can't check that fact. Well, tell us anything you've learned this week. Maybe you just knew everything anyway. I think that's probably true.
I learned that journalists are in jeopardy from NGOs who are apparently paying them to go to conferences.
that's a story in itself.
It is.
I'll tell you what I've learnt. This wasn't technically at the AAAS, but still it counts. Do you know that chickens, don't go deaf? They have better... Well, they do... If they do sort of damage their eardrums and various bits, they grow back. And scientists want to know why. So we can do it too. It's amazing, isn't it?
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
They have got ears, though.
I learned that at MIT. They don't have ears. What do you mean they don't have ears? They've got similar sorts of hearing mechanisms.
All right,
stop
arguing with me. You know what I mean.
Okay, well, look, that's really it from us here at Boston. And we've resisted calling this the Ass Cast. See what we did there. My thanks to James Randerson and Olive Heffernan for their wit, wisdom, and general poddery. I couldn't have done it without you, really. I couldn't. It would have sounded awful. Thanks, of course, also to Gus and everyone here at Toscanini's for their hospitality and delicious ice cream. If you're ever in town, you simply have to come here. We're guessing that if you live or study in Boston, you've probably been here once or twice already. Anyway, if you want to add your thoughts to anything you've heard us discuss in the show, head to blogs.guardian.co.uk/science or post a comment on our Facebook wall. As we've been saying, we've recorded a bunch of interviews with some of the world's leading scientists and most influential academics while we've been here in Boston. People like Harvard stem cell researchers, MIT biological engineers, particle physicists, geneticists, and a chemist who thinks he's got the solution to climate change. Listen out for all of those interviews over the coming weeks and months. But it's with great emotion that I say our first outside broadcast is coming to an end. Science Weekly has been produced by Ben Green. I've been Alok Jha. You want me to say that? I'm not saying that.
Well, say something else.
I'm not going to do it. You're set. Have a great day. That's just so awful.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.